We would like to welcome to the podcast a new sponsor for 2025, HRO Adventures. Rusty and Jackie run the ultimate outdoor adventure location outside of Cooley City, Washington. Rusty provides world-class guided mule deer hunts, guided or DIY pheasant hunts, and other upland bird hunts too. If you have a special occasion coming up, a special corporate outing that you would like to set up, or a place that you would like to do your own private group training, give Rusty a call today. He specializes in the custom experience. Everything from hunting to bird watching you can find at HRO Adventures. Look them up at hroadventures.com and hiddenranchoutfitters.com. Tell them Dave sent you. Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 2 of the HRO Adventures podcast. I'm Dave, and I'm sitting here with Rusty. Good morning, Rusty. How are you?
Good morning, Dave. I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Good. Hey, we're coming to everybody live from the Kittitas Valley Event Center in Ellensburg, Washington. I want to give a big shout out to them for making a space for us to do recording. So if you're hearing echoes, it's the giant auditorium that we're in. So I'm going to welcome everybody. So thanks for making the drive. I led the snowplows on the way over the pass coming here. How was your drive in?
Yeah, mine was completely dry, just cold.
So okay.
We had about a quarter of an inch of snow at our place, and you stole it all before it came over the mountain.
I think it's all in my front yard, yeah.
I heard that.
Well, hey, we are fresh back from being together at the Washington Sportsman's Fair in our sportsman show in Puyallup, and I'd like to get your take on coming off the show. What'd you think?
Oh, man. What an exciting time. It'd been a while since I had actually attended the whole show. I usually went over and spend a day or two, but this is the first time I've been over to spend the whole show for quite a while. And so being able to go over there and share a booth and get some exposure and get to visit and talk with people, which I absolutely just love talking with folks and meeting with people. Funny thing, I wasn't there more than, 2 hours on the first day of the show, and I get a phone call. And so I took the phone call from the hunter, and he was trying to plan another trip and was talking to me and when can I come and what we were doing. We're trying to put it all together for him. And he was thinking he'd probably be back up to the shooting preserve in a week or two, and got off the phone, walked around the corner, and here he was standing there. And he looked at me and he goes, "Didn't I just talk to you on the phone?" I said, "Yes, you did."
Oh my gosh, that's so funny.
We need to
get you one of those truck driver headsets with the boom mics. The amount of time you spend on the phone is so funny. But you hit the nail on the head, right? I've been to these kind of trade shows and boat shows and stuff, you know, as a participant, you know, buy a ticket and go in. But one of the neat things was the sort of camaraderie, almost like you're in hunting camp. At the booth, right? We're there with all these guys we do things with and do projects with, or see them go by on the river, or see their truck parked at the turnout in some places. And, it was a good reminder. You know, it's not, I don't know, at least from my side, it's not as much business as it is. It's connecting and relationships. And, we were in the booth with Dwayne England over there at Fish Hunt Northwest, and he made room for a lot of us all to be in his booth, and give a great shout out to him. What a great host, and just working real well together with him. And it was Mr. Loomis sitting there and Mr. Harridan there, right? So it was kind of a who's who of, gosh, pretty much everybody I grew up watching on TV or listening to on the radio. So it's pretty neat. And I don't think I'm that old, but... it's just kind of neat to be on that side and watching you guys with not really selling anything at the booth, but building relationships, right? People that you hunted with in the past wanted to say hi, people that have looked you up and talked to you on the phone wanted to meet you, and then people that are brand new and interested. So just really neat to be able to sit in the booth, help you guys out, run support stuff, and just watch everybody do their thing. So what was your... I'm surprised you have a voice left after how many days in a row you were talking, but what were some big takeaways you got from the show?
I really enjoyed doing the seeing the people, people coming by going, "Where are you at?"
You know, that was the big question, wasn't it? Where are you located? Yeah.
And so, did you want to mute
I could try it here.
Okay. So yeah, it was kind of a cool deal of being able to answer people's questions. You know, they would come by and they would see the banner and they would see me pick up a card, whatever. And we would talk a little bit about upland bird hunting or whatever. And then they're going, well, where are you at? And I would tell them, you know, the hilarious thing is most people, as soon as you told them what area of the state you were from, they pretty much could nail it down. They knew pretty close to where we were. The funny one was when people would come up and, you know, they're from Western Washington and they really don't know any place in Eastern Washington. That is the funny thing to me. How do you not know the eastern part of the state of Washington? But that is the political part of the divide that we have, that we deal with in the state here too, is people don't think about Eastern Washington and how things affect them. Being able to meet with folks and talk to them and have people come up to me and shaking my hand and saying, man, we were just there. It's been a year or two since we've been in and we need to get back. And man, it's good to see you here. Still glad you're still operating over there. Still got some pheasants. And I would guess the number one question that I got from just about anybody that knew where we were was, yes, we have pheasants still available. And we pretty much run through March. We run into April. Matters what the weather looks like and how warm it gets. But most, we can pretty much hunt the entire month of April. But I'm just like every other shooting preserve. We want to be down to zero birds left when we get to May. We just don't want to feed them through the summer. And everybody quits hunting their dogs when it warms up. So if people need birds, then they need to let me know so I can hold some for them. Otherwise, I'm going to run out. But you can always call and see if I've got any birds left. And I will have birds for them too, up until the end of April probably. But it seems to be there's just a lot of birds out there right now. So a lot of the suppliers and, you know, it was a good year for growing birds. Mine did really well. So did theirs. So there's birds to be had right now. So now's a good time to be coming out.
And the bird flu stuff I'm seeing at the grocery store with the eggs and all that, not affecting any of that kind of stuff right now?
It hasn't affected any of the industry here in the state of Washington as far as the shooting reserves and the pheasants. Yes, it's hit the egg industry and the poultry industry really, really hard. Another dairy they found another dairy that been hit and has bird flu now. So this is the second confirmed case inside of a cattle herd that has the bird flu. So that's going to change things just a little bit of how they're going to handle this. But most of us are very, very careful. You know, if you've got a stay at home flock, you're not going in my pens. You know, if you raise your own birds, you're not going in my pens, and I don't expect to go into anybody else's pens. It's just the way we're going to do it. I don't know how they handle the dairies. I haven't been involved with that when they find it in there.
But if you find it in a flock of birds, it's killed the entire flock.
Yeah, that's what the remedy is, isn't it? So, well, before we go into the bird program, just kind of walk us through, who did you rub elbows with at the show that, you know, hadn't seen in a while? And just, we were talking offline a little bit about some of the personalities. What kind of things did you come across as far as some of the new guys out there and old folks you've done business with before?
But you talked about the camaraderie. You know, that's always the fun thing at a show is, first of all, you become very, very good friends with the booth to your left, the booth to the right, and the two booths across from you. Because all you do is stare at each other all the time when you're not talking to clients. And so that's who you're visiting with. You're getting to know your neighbors and everything else. And like you said, Fish Hunt Northwest was generous enough to give us a little corner of their booth and have us in. And I hope that I added something to their clientele as well, where it's mostly just, you know, about the show and the merch that they sell. But the people I brought in also were buying stuff and doing, so I thought that was kind of fun. But just being able to watch, guys would come up and talk to me. They had watched the pheasant hunt show that Dwayne came and hunted and then his mule deer. And that was fun. The camaraderie that we had there with Dwayne and Jordan, his son, that does most of the camera work, and Matt came. He was the one that filmed the deer hunt, and so Matt was. It was a fun deal, but the neighbors, you know, Richie Harrod and Bob Loomis from Mac Lures was there, and those guys, you know, they're, I guess, Eastern Washington neighbors. You know, they both live within, you know, 70 miles of my house. They both hunt and fish right by my house. So, you know, we know each other from the past. We know each other of what the ground that we go on and that we enjoy and that we recreate on and that we hunt and fish on. And so, and those guys are characters. When you get to spend that much time and you get to see them every day for 4 days or 5 days, as that show was, the stories and the old memories come out, and just watching a bunch of us guys sit there and belly laugh, talking about, you know, our mistakes and falling off the boat and, you know, tripping over a log and whatever else. Those are the fun stories.
Yeah. Yeah. We were cautioned, being careful with podcasts, right? 'Cause you might run out of material. And after sitting in the booth, it's like, you get about 10 years before you got to worry about it. But half the stories aren't for public consumption, right? They just, they're just too funny. But yeah, what a bunch of great, great characters. And then their products are pretty neat too, right? I mean,
oh, absolutely.
The stuff they've made is just, been using that stuff for years, whether it's the lures or some of the cooking stuff that Richie's got. So it was a neat group, and it was literally like sitting around the campfire with guys you've known a long time, and then getting to invite you could say the public could step in and enjoy some of that, not necessarily trying to hard sell anybody anything, right? So it was pretty neat. So
well, that was kind of the fun part of it, though, was that sharing. But we would start sharing about, you know, well, I remember when I hunted in a, you know, I just wore a plaid shirt and blue jeans. You know, there was no camo, and I got a deer. Well, you want to go back to that? Well, no, I'm really liking my Kuyu stuff. So, you know, my wool pants are a lot better than the blue jeans that I used to wear. You know, and listen to those guys with all their experience.
Yeah, it reminds me, you know where Pateras is, right?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of the junction there, or the confluence, whatever you want to call it. A good buddy of mine and we do a lot of fly fishing, but I'm not a zen fly fishing kind of guy. I fish fly fishing when it's a fly fishing restrictive, like that's the only type of fishing you can do, right? So I usually step out of the truck with both. You know, the regular rod and reel, and then the fly rod. And as I would drift and move down or whatever, some of the places I fished, like on the Kalama, they're fly fishing only, right? So now I can step into that and fish that stretch, right? So it's strictly a tactical thing. It's not, hey, I love the fly fishing or zen, or don't even really like to go into fly shops usually, right? They're just, I usually don't need much of what they have. I just tie my own stuff. You know, I know exactly what I need, and I do that. But this friend of mine and I, he's got a military background. I got a military background. We took some courses at Orvis. You know, I know it may not be the right thing to do, but the course they had made sense to do about some fly fishing and specifically some steelhead stuff. And so we took the course. We learned how the fish see at a 30-degree angle, and you don't want to wear a red hat and this and that. And in fact, we pretty much rappelled over the guardrail and then snowshoed into our spot and fished the confluence there just north of Pateras for most of the day. Had, I think, one bite, you know, snow on the ground, your eyelets are frozen up. And, you know, got, I think, one nibble or one hit, and that was it. And, you know, it's just a tough day. That's how that goes. So then drove down to Pateras to the gas station to top off before the long drive back to the west side. And there's three little kids with their Spider-Man rods and a music box blaring music, doing everything we were taught not to. And they're all hooked up on fish. And I'm sitting there fueling the truck thinking, we may have overthought this. And again, you know, Fred Bear, those guys, you know, red flannel shirt, you know, no fancy camo. And I thought, you know, how much of this is the marketing that I've bit off on, and how much of it is actually useful? And the kicker was, not only did the kids have each, it was three of them, and each of them have a fish on, But then they went and pulled up the stringer, and they've been killing it all day. And I suspect they might have even been over the limit. And we were about ready to throw our stuff in the dumpster, kind of like, you know, why do we even try? We've been trying to be stealthy and all this. These kids are, you know, eating Slim Jims and dancing on the dock and reeling them in. And I just remember thinking, we're overthinking it, and they could probably teach us a few things or two. So anyway, just thought I would relate that. But
One of the funniest fishing stories I ever had, or ever saw, was they had a bass tournament there, and they did it out of the park there at Pateras. And the weigh-in was at like, 4 o'clock, 3:30, usual weigh-in, middle of the afternoon. And I knew some of these young kids that are riding bicycles with a fishing rod on the front, you know, handlebars, riding down and that fish the lake right there, you know. And they had that bass tournament, and they did all the weigh-in. And I just remember all those kids were down there looking at the fishermen and watching those fish. And then I don't know who was doing the tournament, who was sponsoring it, but they just turned around on the dock and dumped all those fish right off the dock. And I looked over, it caught my eye. All those little kids that were all these fishing kids, you know, this is what they did after school. They saw all those bass go in the water. They all ran right back to their bicycles. And they were only 100 yards down the shore catching all those bass. Those guys kicked in the water. I laughed so hard. Those kids had that figured out really quick. And the bass guy said, "Yeah, we won't do that again."
Yeah, yeah, that's self-critiquing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, so you know, we got a lot of questions at the show. You know, where's your location? But the other one was you have a pheasant preserve, and you can shoot you know, when you like and all that. So let's go into your bird program. What is it, and what do you offer?
Well, yeah, I grew up next to this pheasant farm and didn't really pay much attention to the regulations or the laws or the rules that went along with raising pheasants. So I've learned all this as I went. Once I took over the pheasants back there and started doing this, didn't know that you had to get a permit to have a shooting preserve. Learned that, you know, and what it takes to get that permit, you know, and some of the silly things that I had seen over the last several decades living next to this bird farm. Found out that I wasn't allowed to do those things. And so what am I allowed to do? Because I was just going to do what I had seen them doing. So learning the rules, learning how to do all of that.
Did you inherit this from somebody, or was it a business that kind of died off and you kind of took over the business and revitalized it? Or
yeah, this was a wheat and cattle ranch next to my family's wheat and cattle ranch. I grew up with the boys. They were just a couple of years older than me, but we rode the bus to school from the time I was in kindergarten until, you know, they quit riding the bus. So probably middle school. About the time I got in middle school was when they quit riding the bus. They were driving to school by then. They started that. That thing started, I want to say it was mid-70s when they started the pheasant farm back there. And it was just a few birds to let people hunt. I'm sure that they got involved in a lot of the rules and regulations as that has changed over the years, because they started so long ago. The one boy, just a couple of years older than me, he actually took it and turned it into a commercial business. And that's when things went really big. He was putting up buildings. He was incubators. He was they were laying eggs. He was picking up his own eggs, incubating them, raising his own chicks, doing chuckers and pheasants. He was delivering to the state of Washington. He had contracts for the state of Washington. And then he had
contracts clear down into Oregon, Idaho.
So would those be those release sites that I see? Because there's a few on the west side there. So is he supplying for the release sites that they have?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And that's how that works then. Yeah. Back before they started doing raising their own birds. You know, Washington State decided they were going to raise their own birds to put out on the release sites. And then once that went away in the state of Washington, he still had other contracts. And then the shooting preserve thing started up, where a lot of people were releasing birds, letting people hunt. You got a longer season, just like I do. My season starts in September and ends in April. My permits do. So, and that's most of the stuff here in the state of Washington. There's always training for dogs and those kind of things. So people can use birds during some of that to do on their own, but they don't have to be on the preserve. But to shoot my birds, you have to be on my preserve. That's the only place I can release.
How big is the reserve preserve?
The state law says they have to be at least 100 acres, and then they can be up to 1,000 acres. So, of course, I got lots of room, so I had no reason to limit it to anything less than 1,000 acres. So I just carved out a few places, or these two places that we can shoot birds around. So both of mine are right at around 1,000 acres. So it gives us lots of room. I can do six groups of four hunters and put them out where they don't bother anybody, with the birds don't cross over.
Yeah. Yeah. They won't even see each other, probably, would they? Yeah. You got so much space out there.
Yeah. So they got a lot of room. Guys can take their time. One guy can be training dogs over here, and the other guys can be, just doing the full as wild as it gets kind of hunt. So yeah, it kind of works out kind of nice.
Yeah. And it's, it's somewhat scenic while you're out there too, right? It's pretty. Go ahead.
There could be days that could be foggy.
Yeah, there could be some fog, that's for sure.
Then there is no scenic part.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Then you can't see in front of your face. Yeah.
Yeah. And over the years, we're on our 11th season since I've took over this place. And there's been a couple of seasons we didn't hunt the month of January or half of January, most of February, because of the snow. Guys that are coming out to shooting preserves do not want to go out in 18 inches of snow and post hole and get their dogs falling through and deal with all of that. And so there's been a couple times we've taken, 4 or 5 weeks off because the snow was too deep. There's been other times, like this year, the snow has never gotten deep enough to it got challenging. 5, 6, 8 inches maybe was the top that we ever had to walk through. But we do live in an area that Waterville Plateau really does lead to fog. And so that you will be up there and you can't see. But boy, when you get a blue sky day up there, you're looking at the Cascades over behind Chelan and over above Terrace. You can see Omak Mountain above Omak, the snow-capped mountains, and that whole prairie flat. To me, it doesn't get any more beautiful than that. That's born and raised there. I'm kind of biased about that.
It's okay. It is a gorgeous place. All right. So with the birds, I think people would be interested to hear, like, start to finish, meaning how do you get a bird at your place and then rear it and take care of it and then all the way up to the release point? What does that look like? Because I don't think people, they're not wild birds, right? There's right. Some wild stuff on your property that you can go for. But as far as specific pheasant, how do you acquire a pheasant and then move on from there?
Well, at the very beginning, I just called some of the pheasant growers around and I went and got truckloads of pheasants, brought them in, had a couple of net pins that I could turn them loose in so they could flap their wings, fly around a little bit, and they were just pins, 75 feet by 50 feet, not really big fly pins or anything, but I wasn't holding them very long. I'd just go get birds and they stayed in the pin for 3 weeks before they were released. That was a long time. Most of them were released and I was just going to get birds all the time. After the first 2 years of doing that, because of this as being an old facility, I fixed up some of the old stuff that had been run down for 15 years, and I fixed it up so I could reuse it. So I fixed up the brooder barn, and then it became ordering chicks, and that is a whole a learning curve in itself. Because, when somebody first told me I could order chicks through the mail, I started laughing, and then I found out it's true. You can. And so
I could see your Google search in your computer that, I'm trying to buy chicks, as many chicks as I can buy. And in the strange algorithms that now you get probably crazy commercials on your, on your iPhone because of that.
Oh yeah, there are a few things on the, you know, websites that pop up now that we can't talk about on the podcast. Maybe you can talk about a podcast. I don't know. I'm not going to talk about them on podcast.
We can. We shouldn't.
Right? There you go. So, I like that. We yeah. can. But we won't. And so, but yeah. So I thought, okay, fine. Well, I'm going to try this. So I fixed up the brewer shed, got them all ready, got the heat up, got propane burners in there. I was told by a very wise helper, a mentor in this business, that you're only as good as your backup system. And he explained it to me. And for those of you that are not really sure what that means, is if you're going to heat your brooder house with electricity, what are you going to do when the electricity goes off? When you're heating a room up to 100 degrees, 101 for chicks, if the electricity goes off in April or May, more than likely, that room will drop below 95 to 90 degrees within an hour. And so I don't care how insulated you are. And so you have to have a backup heat system. As soon as the room cools off, those birds will start piling on each other. And only the ones on top live. And it's a circle of life. It's just the way things go. And it's sad and it's hard to take sometimes. And some people don't even want to think about it. But it is a tough deal. So you are as only as good as your backup. So I went with propane and the propane brooders, and that's a real good, efficient way of heating the room. And it makes for a really nice way to keep those chicks warm. We put them in circles. I can raise about 1,000 in my brooder house, so that's what I do. And it's just a nice, easy, comfortable space that we can do 1,000 in there. We put them in circles, keep the heat in when they're really young. The circles only last about 12 days. By day 14, they're flying out of the circle, so you've got to take the circles out. So, or have food and water on the outside of the circle, which really didn't seem to be effective, the most efficient way of doing it. So we take circles out, and then they're in the room. They do very, very well in there. I've learned what to use as bedding, what not to use as bedding. I've had water lines pop off and flood my room. I've had, you know, one of the guys I buy birds from, adult birds from, he told me, he says, you can call me anytime. I've made every mistake there is to make to screw things up. And so I can help you through some of that. And he goes, and I've made them more than once. So that just tells you I'm not the sharpest tack in the box, but I will help you out. So he's been very, very good sharing what he does.
Interesting. Well, I remember the biologist that you had chatted with, that beautiful terrain you have with some of the canyons also harbors raptor populations, right? And I remember the comment was, you know, figure out what you need to order for your business and order double, because the raptors are going to wipe you out. And you have to do this overestimate to basically feed the raptors so they leave your sellable population alone. I thought that was some of the neatest information. And that was a day we saw a couple of, you know, I think 4 foot tall golden eagles out there. And it was like, oh, yeah, it makes perfect sense. I would have never thought of something like that. So. Interesting twists and turns when you're just trying to do a little bird program, right? So,
well, you know, and I'm telling you about the, you know, my chicks that we were just talking about in my brooder house. It's all contained. All my pens have a net over top of them, so my birds don't escape. Well, it also keeps the raptors from getting into my pen to eat my birds. So the double doesn't really apply to that as much as it does. I learned about this Pheasant Forever group down in southeast Idaho, that they were actually using old water tanks, some of these flat bottom water tanks, these 1,000-gallon ones, you know, 1,500-gallon ones, and they were putting a brooder in there, and they were using them as a segregator. A lot of places you can see these, especially quail, especially down south. They can put a little propane burner, a little 5-gallon propane or 25-pound propane bottle on there and raise 100, 150 quail inside this thing that fits in the back of your pickup. But you can only raise about 70 pheasants in there. And that's just a 5-week program. And when you get to 5 weeks, you open the gate, you let them out, and then you clean the thing out. Two weeks later, you start all over and you just keep raising. You can raise 3 or 4 hatches of these. And this is try to help out a wild population, trying to get something out there. Well, I'd found out about these guys from Southeast Idaho. So we went down and visited with them and got a couple and brought them up here and we tried them out. And that was the first thing that guy told me. He goes, whatever you think you're releasing, you know, half of those are going to feed the predators. And I'm going, man, I got coyotes, but I don't think I have that many coyotes. Well, he goes, well, coyotes aren't even in the top 1 or 2 predators that you're dealing with. He goes, the predators you're dealing with are owls and hawks. And I was like, oh, what a wake-up call. He's absolutely right. We learned just from the stuff we put out on the shooting preserve. I put the stuff out on the shooting preserve, and all the hawks show up. They figure out right away, these guys are going to walk around out here and shoot 90% of them, but they're going to leave us one. You know, or they're going to leave us, you know, 1 out of 10, they're not going to get that one. And so which one of us gets that one? And so all the hawks show up.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that it's really kind of, the predator situation goes clear into the sharp-tailed grouse being sensitive species, the sage grouse being a listed species. And then yet, all they want to do is regulate the farmers on how we build a fence or how we farm ground, when the top two things that affect sage grouse populations is wildfire and predation. And we can't even talk about those.
Yeah, nobody put the hawks in the meeting, did they?
No. You know, or even the ravens raiding the nest and eating eggs. All of those things, you know, we can't even talk about that because we have treaties that we can't shoot ravens, even though one dead cow will have 200 ravens on it, you know, in 24 hours. I've seen the golden eagles get hungry enough that they'll come in on a dead cow, you know, in somebody's herd or a dead calf. So, you know, those are huge things. The owls. I was my first year. I would find headless pheasants in my pen. And I'm going, what is happening here?
Yeah, there's a telltale look when a bird's been hit by one of those, right? Very obvious that's what got it. So, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I had to ask the biologist, I says, how come I'm having pheasants in my side, my pen, that I can tell something is eating the head off of? So how did the pheasant die to begin with? And he goes, well, more than likely it was a hawk or an owl that the pheasant would get up in the net, and they could hit that net and catch the pheasant, and then they would eat the head off. And so I'm going, really? And horned owls are the worst. Horned owls are actually, you don't have to do, just sit down for an hour or two on on YouTube, Google, whatever you want to do, and you will find out. I am super impressed. Owls have to be the best hunters of all. They're quiet. They're quieter than any other bird. They hunt at night. Oh my goodness. They take thermal to a whole new level.
Yeah, they got thermal. They got Doppler. They got stealth. You know, those end of the wing feathers make no noise going by. Doing lots of hikes in Mount Rainier and snowshoe kind of stuff with Boy Scouts, right? You'll see a raven go by and you hear it, you know, whoo, 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 whoo. But the raptors and especially the owls have those specialized feathers and you will never hear them coming, right? Yep. And, you know, something the size of a small pocket dog flying through the air. And where I live, people wonder why their pets disappear. And, you know, it's like, yeah, this thing will snatch your cat or your small dog and go off with it. And you'll never know. Was always the telltale sign, was the way the head was removed, you could tell it was an owl, you know, and just such a cool hunting machine, those things. And you know, I first growing up in the South and doing hunting and fishing in the South, right, learning about the barred owls and the who cooks for you, who cooks for y'all was the way they sound, right? And everybody used to make the owl call with their hand. Like I remember the old guys would do that, mm-hmm. for a you know, for a call for turkeys, right, to startle them, to get them to gobble, shock gobble. And it's funny to watch Phelps and all these guys have these shock calls. And I'm like, I remember these guys do that with a piece of grass and their hands. And we never really knew why they always made that sound, but that was the try to get a shock gobble, right? Because you sounded like the barred owl predator. So yeah, pretty neat stuff. So
predators are a big thing. So, you know, once we get ours in that brooder house and we get to the point where we can start letting them out of the pen, we start turning the heat down, you know, you're just, everything's just a 1 week, 2 week thing, 3 weeks, what you do at week four, letting them outside where they can come and go in the heat, out of the heat. Then you turn the heat completely off and then it's just protection inside, but they really want to be outside. The pens get bigger. You get to where you're turning them loose. That's when I have to worry about predators. This is when I'm turning them loose, ripping the net. Hawk can get right into the pen. So you have to be careful about that. Of course, then you got wind. You got all the other things that come along with that. I've had coyotes chew through the wires and get in. And, you know, a coyote gets in. I had 550. I just got a load of birds, and I had 550 in the pen. They'd been in there for maybe a week. I show up. As I'm showing up, I can't see anything walking around in the pen. I got cover in there for them, and so I just thought, this is weird. When I finally got closer to the pen, I could see there were some dead pheasants in there. I actually thought I had something, that the predator was in the pen. And so I went in there to take care of this, find the predator and take care of it. But the predator already been, they'd already left. And by this time, didn't take much of a deal to find the hole in the fence that they had chewed through the wires, and they had gotten in there. They had buried a couple of pheasants, probably ate one or two, and it was a mother and two pups, and they killed 289 roosters that I could count. So
that's a shot for me.
Yeah, and those darn coyotes, right? A lot of the predators will kill what they need, right? They'll take one, but those darn guys will wipe out the whole thing. They won't stop. And it's just a unique way they're wired, but they will, I guess they're gluttons or something, but they will wipe out the whole darn thing on you, won't they?
Well, I think the best word for it that I thought, and I think it serves true, is they call it a thrill kill. At first it's, you know, we're hungry. That's why we got in to begin with, because we're hungry. We got in here, we killed one, we ate it, you know, and hey, there's more. So let's kill another one and bury it so we can come back. So the whole wild instinct, dinner now, dinner for tomorrow, came into play. Then they were full. And then it's like, wow, you know, this is kind of fun. We don't usually get to kill like this. And so then, especially at night when the birds are docile, they're really easy to catch, and especially when there's all in a pen. And so they just go from one to the other killing it.
Yeah, crazy stuff. Let's see. So you're picking up, you get an order of chicks. How long do you keep them before they're releasable? What kind of weeks or how long do you take care of them before their time to release on the preserve?
Well, I've been doing it long enough now. This, like I said, this is my 11th season, so I got a lot to learn for sure. But I've learned enough to, I have an opinion on that exactly. I read a lot of stuff online that, you know, hey, raise this Kansas blueback and you can be hunting them in 18 to 20 weeks. Well, you know, I've raised some Kansas bluebacks now. At first, you know, I didn't know there was a difference between pheasants. You know, they all look like pheasants to me.
Yeah, I've just learned that just now.
So, there's different species of pheasants. There's ringnecks and there's Kansas bluebacks and there's, you know, Manchurians and there's Manchurian ringneck crosses. And then there's molinistics that are the black ones. And so, you know, there's just different ones out there that are really kind of make it fun for the guys at the, on the shooting preserve, because we can mix and match and throw them out there. But my opinion on the deal is I don't want to sell a bird till it's 22 weeks old. There is a huge difference in that last 4 weeks between 18 and 22. The ring around the neck becomes very, very sharp and very, very white. The colors in the wings, colors across the back, they become very, they almost get that illuministic or that effervescence almost color that kind of comes out as it changes in the sun as you turn it. And so you start,
that green. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that the guys like that better. If you're coming to shoot pheasants and you're wanting good color on your birds and you want it to, and the tails, in that last 4 weeks, tails get longer. And it's just a better bird. If all you want to do is come and you're just training your dog and you're just getting some scent, yeah, I think they fly pretty good around that 18 to 20 weeks. But as far as colors go, I just do 22. So that first batch of birds, I go backwards. I know I'm going to start the last weekend in September. So I just go back, 23 weeks, 22 weeks before that and get my chicks in. So that first 500 chicks, first 1,000 chicks, they're going to be 22 weeks come that first or that last of September weekend.
Interesting. Cool. Yeah. So there's like a little fine touch in there to make sure they're just at the peak of what they can be. So yeah, pretty cool. Yeah.
So, it's kind of fun. I like doing the chicks. One of the other hard lessons I learned was, yes, the Postal Service will bring them right to the, they will not bring them to your house. You have to go to the post office and get them. So,
Can you imagine what that postal truck would look like after he drops off at your house? He'd have to hose that thing out.
So that first year I ordered, I had two batches of chicks coming in. The first one came in and everything worked fine. Absolutely perfect. Second batch came in and the postmaster calls me and says, hey, your chicks are in. I go down there. It was a super cold week. It was freezing. And I get down there and I'm going to pick up these boxes and they come in boxes of 140. And I went down to pick up my boxes. I think I only had 300 at that time. They were coming in three boxes and they were super quiet. And usually you should be able to hear those chicks in there peeping around what they're doing, making the sound. And they're super quiet. I can only hear a few, throw them in the pickup. I noticed by the time I left the post office and drove the 18 miles to my house, to the brooder house, I get there, that things were picking up. I was hearing more. I opened the box and half of them were gone. They had froze. They'd got, I don't know if they froze, but they got too cold. And so I don't even think I had a 25% of that order make it, because the stress on them, they just don't, even the ones that were there didn't last very long.
Yeah. They probably don't travel, they're not super, tough. They're pretty sensitive. So,
well, and it interesting kind of goes on how they get transported from the time that they get put in the box to where they're at. So that's, there you go. That's the tip of the week, I guess, is find out, how the chicks that you're ordering are going to be put in a box, get to the airport, get to the or get to the mailbox to get to you. Because I've learned my lesson now. I go and I pick them up off the plane. Mine come in on a plane from Minneapolis to straight shot to Spokane. And so I've done it long enough now. I know when that plane usually comes in. And so I'm sitting in Spokane. And as soon as I see that they've crossed the scanner in the Spokane distribution center, I go to the distribution center, turn in my deal, and they'll go and bring me the boxes out. Now, that's kind of fun, though, when you get to tell, I had a bunch of high school boys working spring break one time. And they said, what are you doing this weekend? And I said, so I'm going to the airport to pick up chicks. Those boys didn't have a clue what I was talking about.
Can I go with you?
And so, now those boys, it's been several years now, and those boys every year, are you picking up chicks at the airport this weekend? And so, yeah, they're just funnier than bunny. So.
Yeah, that's Rusty's tip, right? Keep your chicks warm. That's going to be on YouTube. We're going to have algorithms and satellites lining up, taking us to places we never even thought existed. So. I'd have to put something extra in the plate at church this week. So.
Tune in next week. See what
happens to this podcast. Exactly. Well, I've got your calendar pulled up here.
Oh yeah.
And I see the Salt Lake Outdoorsman show is on there.
Oh yeah.
So what's going on down there? You're heading that way, it looks like.
I love that show down in Salt Lake. You know how the Puyallup show kind of gets you the Northwest glow of things. I meet all the fishermen and the hunters from the Northwest and all the buddies that you see and you might hunt with or hunt around or see, you know, on the road, whatever. Those are the fun ones. Those are the fun guys. But you go to Salt Lake and now all of a sudden you're in the Hunter Expo. You know, it's the big one. You get all the high end guys that are coming down there selling the high end hunts, you know, where I have, you know, 16 mule deer that we sell a year, you know, sell hunters an opportunity for, you know, you go down there and it's the bighorn sheep and it's the doll sheep and it's Alaska bears.
Yeah. It's all the cool sheep hunts and just the terrain and the gear needed to do that kind of thing is so different and just fun to look at.
You know, and I just love going down there and seeing them. I've made some really good friends, and I'm seeing outfitters that I've hunted with in other states, and I get to stay in touch with them. It's become very valuable to me, a value professionally, because I'm talking to guys that are dealing with other rules and other laws in other states. And in some respects, Washington has we have a good thing or two. In other respects, I see some stuff in other states that I wish that we could implement here and do that way. So it kind of helps me that way as well, politically. You know, if I've got to buy these permits for the shooting preserves, and I've got to deal with Fish and Game because I have a business, and so they check me and do things. It's always good to know what the rules are and be at least in tuned what's going on, especially now with the legislature in session and what things are out there for them. So I get a little bit of that down there.
Yeah. There's so many things changing, right? Anything you can do to be on the front edge of a change coming or a change being discussed or even be included is, definitely helpful.
Yeah, absolutely.
We live in a beautiful place where I can go up to the counter and pretty much buy, you know, go hunt elk or whatever. And a lot of places that I fly to for my day job, it's lotteries. And, you know, the guy only got picked once in 5 years. And so there's a give and a take, right? We have a neat place. We have so much public land. And as I fly around, I see, you know, there's parcel programs and this gate's open and they look like little pumpkin patches as you see all the, you know, like that's apparently the spot to hunt today, you know, and the other one across the street's not open till tomorrow. So, you know, I try to remind myself of that and just take it all in stride and, you know, pay attention to what's going on and, you know, write to the appropriate people or go to the appropriate meetings or join the appropriate groups to try to facilitate, you know, keeping what we have and trying to keep making it better and better. But we sure are lucky.
Yeah, so, we are.
At the end of the day, I like what I have compared to when I see other people, what they have to do to hunt just every year. So,
well, in Washington State, we have over-the-counter tags. And I don't know how much longer we're going to be able to keep that going. But we have that right now. And guys, don't take it for granted. Enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah, and don't put something off, right? You never know. It's a stroke of a pencil that or a pen that can go away. So think in 5 years you'll do something or whatever. I would accelerate my timeline. Let's call Rusty and come out and do an adventure and, you know, go put the boat in and go buy the boat and do all those things because a stroke of a pen, these rules change. And we see that a lot on the fishing side, right? They close up stuff and everybody owned a boat and went to, you know, the different stores and has all the stuff. No season this time. So that could easily end up being in the hunting side if we're not careful. So
we've already seen it in some of these areas. You know, we have the desert unit right now where there is no over-the-counter deer tag. You have to draw for whatever you do there. We're seeing it in the elk with the bull tags and the branched antlered bull tags and those kind of things in the eastern Washington units or areas. And so they're starting to, there is that management practice already inside the department. So it wouldn't surprise me to see that expand or to see. So, you know, be watching, be careful, be taking a look at all that stuff. So
that's just one of those things.
Yeah. So part of being an outdoors guy is, you know, I think everybody would agree there's a conservation aspect to it as well, right? We talked a little bit about some of the groups that I had talked to that maybe are more on the granola electric car side and don't necessarily spend money on stuff, right? Everything they do is sort of discounted or free. And it's usually, you know, the outdoorsman groups that are putting in the culvert or helping to get the pit toilet set up at the parking areas or whatever. And I think there's just a big conservation part when you become a hunter, you know, when you buy your ammo and buy your duck tags and things like that, right? There are taxes in there for conservation, and your outdoor and your hunter and your fisherman are kind of the big supporters of these programs, right? And so with conservation comes paying attention to what goes on at the legislature and what rules are up and what bills are up and, hey, wait a minute, what's that doing? And so there's, you know, it's easy to just put the boat in or just go hike in and start hunting, but you do have to pay attention to what's going on when the legislature's in and when they're trying to change some things that might affect your hobby and the things that you love to do and share. So,
yeah. So, you know, that's the thing about our state, but down at the show in Salt Lake, you know, getting to hear how, you know, everybody doesn't like what their state does, doesn't like everything their state does. And so you kind of get a little bit of that. But I love listening to the hunting stories down there, doing things that I don't get to do, that I've had to pay to go hunt elk, and I've had to do those kind of things. But just listening to those guys, and then also listening how they do things. You know, there's guys that, you know, especially in Alaska and other places, that they have to fly into, and Canada's that way, and how they get around. I'm fascinated by all that. But there's always little tricks that I pick up from those guys, how they deal with things that I still do, even though I'm in a pickup, or, you know, I don't have to, you know, hike 5 miles, 10 miles into the areas that I take my clients. So I pick up a lot of the tools of the trade down there. The other thing down in Salt Lake is it's became one of the premier shows in the nation that you can go to, that all of the gear guys are there. So I've went down there, and, you know, I carry Zeiss binoculars, and so I always go over and check out what's new at the Zeiss binocular booth and how that's going. There's some other people down there that wholesale some of that stuff out that'll do outfitter discounts, signing up. You know, they just want to make sure that you're an outfitter, and so, you know, you have to prove, and they have to see, and the goes a lot on what I can show them and how I can, you know, prove to them that I'm an outfitter. And so we do a lot of those kind of things. But the outfitter stuff was good. You know, I was one of these guys that, you know, I made fun of my daughter when she bought a pair of pants that was more than $18. You know, you know, my pants are Wranglers that are $22 a pair.
Yeah, don't get me started on girls and their clothing.
So, you know,
be working till I'm 80 here.
You know, and my wife's the cook at camp and deer camp, and, you know, her and I have all these years doing this. I just can't spend that much money on a pair of hunting pants that I'm going to wear just for one season or two seasons. And so one year here, about 6-7 years ago, Jackie got after me, and she says, "Okay, I'm tired of you being the one guy that looks like a clown. And you're the outfitter. You're supposed to be at least as good as your hunters that are coming in here, you know." And I had hunters that were bringing in all the latest, the newest, you know, Kuyu stuff, the latest Sitka stuff, the latest, you know, Predator camo, Bill Jordan's, you know. So all of these things, Mossy Oak, I saw it all because I all these guys coming in. And so we were in Salt Lake that year, and she goes, "You need to go over to this booth because they sell hunting clothes." And so I went over.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. I walk out of there with a pair of pants, a vest, a coat. That might have been it, just the three. Maybe. Oh no, I bought two pairs of pants because you have to wash one once in a while. She had to tell me that too, I think. So I think I bought two pairs of pants, a vest, and a coat, and I was almost $700. And I cried all the way
out. You got out cheap. It is amazing what that stuff costs. And so, it's always funny. I see it in the boat mostly, but you know, it's pretty neat. You can come out and get free salmon, and it's like, hey, this might be the most expensive salmon you've ever eaten. By the time we do engines and kicker motors, and in this case, you know, camo and scope cost more than a rifle, and it's like, you know, this isn't free stuff. This is very expensive. So that's pretty funny.
But I have went full circle on that though, Dave, because now she looks at my closet and she knew how much that first set of Kuyu cost. And now there's like, you know, 7 shirts, 4 pairs of pants, 4 vests, 3 jackets. She's going, uh-oh, may have created a monster here.
Yeah. And most of that stuff is, you know, kind of overpriced and whatnot. But the Kuyu stuff, man, I've been to their road shows and hopped in the semi and tried stuff on, and they make nice stuff, and it's almost like they're making it for me. It's like it fits, and this is exactly where I'd put the pocket. And so that the Kuyu, I'm a little partial to, just because it's like it's really well thought out, and I do like their stuff. So, you know, I got a lot of their stuff hanging around too.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Well, and to be honest, you know, she proved her point. You know, I went in and I got to try everybody's on. They were all at the show, so I went on and I tried all of the stuff and felt the fabric and got her opinion on it. And so I'm still wearing now the same. I still have those first two pairs of pants are in there, and that's usually what I wear out first. You know, I'm just crawling around on my knees, or I'm sitting down on the ground all the time, or they're getting absolutely soaking wet, or, you know, you're going through the sagebrush, ripping them, and barbed wire fences, all that stuff just really takes a toll on your hunting gear, you know. And when I was still doing the Walmart brand, you know, I got 1, maybe 2 years out of it, and you were buying new because it just wore out. And just
lucky if you make it back to the truck.
There was a couple times that, yeah, you'd made it back to the truck, but there was a big rip down your shirt or whatever. So, you know, I got to say, I think it's overpriced because I just don't want to pay that much. I don't know if it's overpriced or not, but
is it worth it? Yeah, it is. So
it is.
Well, cool. So you're going to be walking around at the show, or which booths are you going to be spending some of your time at?
Well, I recently, last year was my first year that I bought a suppressor for my hunting rifle. And I was talking to several of the gun makers down there. I've got hunters that shoot them all and shoot just about every one of them, it seems like, and over the years. And so I was talking to some of them about some of the things they're doing, and I like to look from the outside into the long range shooting guys, and there's several of those there. And so I'm talking to the gun manufacturers, and we walked out of the Bagheera booth, and it was, you know, when the show was getting slow at the very end, and I was sitting there with my buddy Skip. And we were talking to the Bagheera guys, and we were the only non-permitted guys to come in the show. The rest of them all worked for Bagheera, you know, and we were standing there talking to them, and we got all, as we were talking to them there, every single one of them had a suppressor on the end of his hunting rifle. I think there was 8 of them. And then there was the 2 of us. And as we walked away, I looked over to Skip and I said, are we the only guys in that booth that did not have a suppressor on their hunting rifle? And so I felt like I was being left behind in the industry. So I started talking to everybody the next day, and we only went to, I only talked to another 10 hunters, you know, guides, hunters that I know there that have good clients and things. Yep. Skip and I were the only ones that did not have a suppressor on the end of their rifle. So, I went and bought one. And so, I don't know that it's for everybody. There's pros and cons for it. There's a lot more pros in my mind now than there was before. I feel like it was an impulse buy for me, and it was kind of a keeping up with the Joneses, but boy, am I glad I've done it. I know, listening to the guys, I don't go to a shooting range because I live in the middle of one. And so it doesn't make a difference to me, but I know guys that do go to the shooting range. They don't want to go when there's people there shooting high caliber rifles, magnums, and those things without suppressors. The sound reduction alone is unbelievable, and it's so much more comfortable for people. And you know, maybe I won't get a hearing aid now for another, maybe I gained like 6 months or a year before I'll have to get a hearing aid because, it made that much difference. So I'm going to be like everybody else now and go for my second one, probably this year. I'll go, there's usually 8 or 9 people down there that are selling different ones. And so you can kind of talk to them and get, and I like that. I like face-to-face buying and I like picking up stuff. I can do my research online on my own, but I really like sitting there talking to somebody, especially if they've used it.
Yeah, to be able to hold it, look at it, ask questions with the guy who, you know, didn't assemble it, but it's not too far removed from the guy that put the glass in it, right? Or the baffles in it or whatever's going on. That is pretty, pretty cool. You guys have predator hunting options where you're at. Are people using suppressors for that?
I do. Yeah. I have one coyote guide that I use for anybody that wants to go on a guided hunt. And it's amazing. I didn't think anybody would ever pay for a coyote hunt. But you know, 8 years ago we took him on and he took some guys coyote hunting. I had some guys call me, so I had to find somebody. And so, I can call coyotes, but I'm not going to call them professionally because I think I'm terrible. I don't think I sound like a coyote or what they want, where he does.
And well, I did some deer hunting a few years ago. I usually use a blind and do archery in a blind usually. And I was rattling and doing the snort calls and all that. And I had some buddies with me and didn't get any deer, but I called in coyote after coyote after coyote with his three buddies. And it was like, do I sound like a wounded deer? I must sound like a super sick about to die deer that so many coyotes have honed in on me. So we kind of ended that program because that just wasn't working. But it was like, gee, I must sound horrible. So I guess I got to work on that a little bit more.
Well, you know, and Fox Pro makes one that you don't have to make a sound for, you know. So, but anyway, I have a guide that really does that. And he came out, and over the years, he has just continually learned our area. And so he does a fantastic job of helping us maintain the numbers there. Learned a lot of lessons about coyote hunting since that time and listened to a lot of professional guys and guys that only like predator hunting coming that I've got to learn from. But one of the things that's really taken over the coyote hunting and the predator hunting in our area is the thermal scopes.
Boy, did that make things
sick. Yeah, that's a whole new dimension, isn't it?
Yeah, and so he'll come out and those fancier scopes have video right in them. And so he's posting all the time, his videos. And I just love the way that is so much better than, spotlighting. Spotlighting is not a bad way of hunting. It's something that we've, you know, as a kid and even years up into my adult years doing that. And that's kind of fun. But boy, when you turn that spotlight on, you didn't always see everything you're going to see. Those thermals, I mean, my goodness, he's showing me pictures and he can watch these coyotes walk right through the cows where you didn't know if there was a cow there or not until you'd hit the spotlight. That thermal, he waits till it clears. You know, it's
a really cool item.
Yeah, it is a neat skill builder. You learn about how the animals move around at night and just all around, neat to add that to the bag of tricks. So what, is there a specific season for predator hunts or how does that work if somebody wants to come do something like that at HRO Adventures?
There is no bag season on coyotes. So it's a year round shooting. You can do it. Most guys do it. They like the hair. They can sell the hides for something when they haired out really well for the winter. So most of the best hunting and the coyotes haven't been called a lot in November. October, November. So most of the time after deer season, we'll let the guys come out and start.
Yeah, okay.
The other thing is during the, when cabin season's on for the cow guys, I've tried to over the past several years steered him to helping some of those guys out. Cause some of them will have once they get a dead cow, they have to drag that thing off because if they don't, it'll attract everything to the herd. So, and then that just makes for, you know, that's a place that's going to congregate the predators. So And those are good places to go to help you raise your success numbers. And so we try to help those guys out.
And what time of the calendar is this, the calving season? Like I imagine you're helping your neighbors out with their ranches and stuff. So
yeah, calving season up in our area, the local guys will go start. Some of them will start as early as, you know, January, end of January. And then they'll calve all the way up through April. Some of them, well, you might see a calve or two hit the ground in May. The older farmers that have gotten established and kind of figured things out, they don't like dropping them in the mud. So
that's what I was wondering.
Miss,
yeah.
Yeah. Miss those seasons. So it's kind of where you live, what works for you.
Okay.
But predator hunting is a good one. It's a good one to come out and practice. It's a good one to come out. There's not a lot of people out. Most predator hunters in our country, because we live in a rural area, are road hunters. They don't get very far from the truck. I say all that because I'm just going to say that's the majority of the coyote hunting that's done, if you just wanted to talk about coyote hunting. The other part is, you know, guys like me, we live there. You're going out and checking cows 3-4 times a day. The rifle's right in the truck. So you take advantage of opportunities when they come to you. You're not really searching them out or calling them in or anything. You're just taking the opportunity when it comes.
Sure. And you're following all the rules on, you know, not having loaded stuff in the truck and, you know, being safe and all that. But yeah, I see what you mean. You know, you're going to stumble across them while you're doing your daily routines.
That's the predator hunting for us. I do have a couple of, on my hunting leases. We have some places where bears will come. We'll see one or two maybe in the fall. I've had a couple of guys tell me, you know, they would really like to shoot a bear, because when we were deer hunting or when we were archery hunting, we'd run across scat, see the tracks. And I don't share the trail cam pictures with everybody, but until it's, you know, relevant, but I have bears on my trail cam pictures. And so we kind of know when they're around and stuff. The only bears we've ever taken, I just don't sell a hunt just to sell a hunt to take somebody out to get some money. So I won't sell one or take guys out unless I know I've got one on trail camera and there's a pretty good chance we're going to. And usually if I know I've got somebody coming, I won't even sell it or take them out until I go out and put eyes on it, that I know it's actually here. It's not just showing up at my trail camera.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's all part of the quality of the program you run too, right? As you're not just getting bodies out there, but it's got to be a exceptional experience for each individual person.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and that's kind of the same way we run the access program, you know, for HRO Adventures. We're only going to work with landowners and guides for the duck and goose hunting that are going to take you out and give you the best opportunity. Hunting's hunting, and you're hunting wild animals, and it's a foggy day or a rainy day or a snowy day or a blue sky day or a hot day or a windy day. We can't choose that. That we can't control. We can only control what we want, and there's going to be days that, you know, it's just like your fishing day in Pateras. You don't catch that day. You know, so we know those days come. Most hunters understand that. They just need to make sure that they, you know, that they know that we can't control those things either. We can only control what we can. But I only pick the places, and we only book the hunts that we know are highest success rate. Trying to get guys, and I get guys ask me all the time if I guarantee them a deer. The answer is no, hard no. I don't guarantee anything.
Yeah, the deer will be here at, you know, 3:35, right around this corner, you know. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And so we don't, the only thing I tell most of them, as I says, I don't, you know, in the 26 years I've been taking guys out, I don't know that I've ever not shown one of my deer hunters a legal buck. So, but that's not a guarantee. I'm still not guaranteeing it. It's just a, you know, my deal is to not overhunt anything, whether it's chuckers, geese, or whether it's deer. If you come and shoot a deer with me, my hope that I always try to is that you saw another legal deer, so that you will come back next year. You will know there's one in the bag for next year. We got to find him. He's got to grow. He's got to make it. You know, He's got to cross the road at the right time so he doesn't get hit.
He's got to do all those things.
Yeah, and that's an important point, is this isn't hunting for the sake of hunting or shooting for the sake of shooting. You're right in the middle of conservation and wildlife management and being selective on what you shoot, when you shoot, when you're hunting. You know, there's land conservation, land ownership, relationships with other landowners. So, you know, it's not just hunting. That's kind of the flashy part of it, right, that everybody sees. But there's so much management that goes into it to make it work properly. So
yeah,
super cool what you guys do out there. Yeah. Well, we're getting close on our time, but we've talked about pheasant stuff. So when should somebody start signing up for pheasant hunts?
Right now is a really good time. We're just into February, a week or two past the end of the season. It's a really good time to come out, get your dog some more time, you know, more pheasants on the ground, to get him out there and let him have some more fun, or her, and just let him hunt a little bit more. The hunting is going to be good on the shooting reserves for the next 2 months for sure. It's going to be cool enough. You should be able to come out and enjoy the time. The dog won't get overheated. You know, the birds are all fully grown now. There's nothing left out there. Even the other growers that you know, anything that they've hatched clear into July, you know, July and August will be old enough now to be hunted. So all the preserved birds, you know, all that, the state's not releasing anymore. The season's over. So it's all on the shooting preserves. And now's a really good time to go do that. Those of us that have places where you can stay, I've got my two cabins, you know, Sun Lakes Park Resort has their places, their cabins down there that we've been able to use. We're using their new ones. They've got 12 of those units that we can put, two-bedroom units, so we can put people in. And I know the people, and I live right there, so I've seen them, but I've talked to the guys that have stayed in them, and they've all been extremely happy.
Yeah, these are not rustic. They're pretty nice. So,
no. Yeah. No, what I have is rustic.
So. I don't know. What you have is, you know, it's nicer than anything I lived in when I was stationed, you know, in Texas in the military. So, yeah, that was pretty nice.
Well, and it's private, so that's the big thing we got, is you guys can come out and enjoy the rest of the day, even when
exactly.
You're not
hiding. Yeah, sight so. Stuff in right there and all kinds of things. All right, so if folks out there want to start getting more information or schedule pheasant hunts, we send them to HROAdventures.com, correct?
Yep, HROAdventures.com. We'll get you right on to what we're doing as far as all the others. We got some other stuff coming up later in the spring, so you're going to want to be paying attention on those things, as we're going to announce those before they.
Yeah. So now, you know, now is the time here, mid-February coming up, is the time to reach out to Rusty, get things on the books, get coordinated. And we're going to have some fishing coming up in March also. So a lot of really cool options. If somebody is going to be at the Salt Lake show, how can they track you down and maybe meet up with you?
That would be fantastic, actually. I'm going to be showing up there on Thursday. That's the first day of the show. And so I will be coming into town that day. They have a banquet that night. I always think that's a great way to start the show off for me, is to go in and say hi to everybody and then go to the banquet. And we can all sit back and relax. And if you guys would call my cell phone, text my cell phone and say, hey, you know, we heard you're in town. We heard you're going to be around. We'd love to run into you, see you, you know. Even if you don't want to go to the banquet, just let me know you're around, and we'll set up a time when you can come by, and we'll have lunch together or go get a cup of coffee or whatever. So, yeah, just call my cell phone, text me. You can email me. I'm sure I'll look at those when I'm having breakfast in the morning, or – you know, maybe just before I go to bed.
Or when you're going to bed, yeah. What's the number for HRO Adventures that you want people to text at? Because that'd be neat to be able to meet up with some folks on the show floor or out at the front door.
Yeah, so my cell phone number that's on all the cards, on all the websites, is 509-681-0218. That's the one I've had forever. And it's my original cell phone number. I've never changed it. Imagine that, having it for that long. But yeah.
All right. And what, give me the number one more time.
509-681-0218.
All right. Well, you know, super appreciative to the folks at the Kittitas Valley Event Center to make a space for us so we could meet halfway in the blizzard that's out there. And look forward to doing some more remote podcasts. We got a couple neat things lined up when we get into some spring and some fishing time. So, Rusty, thanks for making the drive. Appreciate it. Any parting words?
Well, I want to thank you for coming over the pass. I had all the good roads and you had the bad ones this time. So I know how that goes. And so that was good. I'm having so much fun right now. This is a fun time of the year when things are winding down for me. Not quite doing as much hunting. We don't have any of the wild stuff. We're only doing the shooting reserve. So that's helping me. But going to the shows, living out of your truck, you know, I told Dwayne, I says, you know, I sure appreciated him letting me be part of his booth there at the show. But I felt like the friend that calls and says, hey, can I sleep on your couch for a couple of days? And so it was fun.
Yeah, there's a fine line between hobo and outdoorsman, right? And it's like the truck is like the defining. If they saw me dragging my stuff in, they just kind of feel sorry for the homeless guy. And it's like, this is just how much garbage I've got to carry just to do what I'm doing today. So. Well, so look Rusty up at HROAdventures.com and also at the HiddenRanchOutfitters.com. Those are the two sites. You got his phone number there. Please, if there's something that you custom make, you know, custom made for, what do we have, a bachelor party I saw in the books, some corporate events, you want to get some dog training in and need a place to hold it, get a hold of Rusty. He's an expert at these custom outdoor solutions to get you an adventure. So HROAdventures.com and HiddenRanchOutfitter.com. And also just reach out, email, get a hold of him, get him on the phone, and he'll have something for you. So, Rusty, till next time.
Well, Dave, I just thought of something as we were in there.
Yeah, what you got?
We videoed this one.
Yeah, we're going to see if we can put this together.
So, Hidden Ranch Outfitters has a YouTube channel. So,
hey, there you go.
Might watch. It might pop up there. We'll see. You and me are trying something new. But.
We're getting better at that stuff. Yeah. So we're leaning way out over our toes and trying to see if we can do this stuff. So.
Now the comments may come back after they see the video. Don't do that anymore. But
yeah, much better hunter than we are podcast person. Yeah, but well, hey, so we got to start somewhere, right?
Exactly. So. Well, David, thanks for coming. This has been another fun time.
Great. All right. Well, I appreciate it, Rusty. Everybody take care, be safe. And again, rules can change quick. Health can change. Family situations can change. Don't wait, for later. Call Rusty, get your adventure going now, and just start living that good life, doing these adventures outdoors. So take care. And we'll talk to you on the next one. Mm-hmm.